what we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. Any of us saw the news on Friday afternoon that LA's own billionaire philanthropist Eli Broad died at the age of 87. Known for his huge impact on the City of Angels as a contemporary art collector who shared his support with just about all the major arts organizations here in Southern California, founded, of course, his own Broad Museum to show his contemporary art collection on Grand Avenue, with a major role in the fundraising and construction for Walt Disney Concert Hall, the development of Grand Avenue, and, of course, making his mark in public education as well through his philanthropic endeavors. He co-founded the home building pioneer Kaufman and Broad, made his fortune there, and then after that launched financial services giant Sun America Incorporated. And after those two major career endeavors, turned his attention to philanthropy in the signature areas in which he was most interested. We begin, as we look at the legacy of Eli Broad on Los Angeles, with an interview that I conducted with him back in 2012. He'd just written his memoir, The Art of Being Unreasonable, Lessons in Unconventional Thinking. Here's an excerpt of that conversation. Your book prominently features a George Bernard Shaw quote that's engraved on a paperweight your wife Edie gave you years ago. Do you want to quote it or should I read it?
Why don't you read it?
All
right. She gave it to me after we were married about a year.
The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable man persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends upon the unreasonable man. That, of course, the theme of your book.
Exactly.
So you've seen this paperweight on your desk for many, many years now. Is this something that
you've... About 55 years.
Yeah. You've been married almost 60 years, right?
Well, we'll be married 58 years December 19th.
Congratulations. So remarkable. So, I mean, clearly you've had a lot of time to think about the unreasonable man idea. Is this something you've applied to yourself for many of these years?
I have. Even as a child, I'd always ask a lot of questions and so on. And I'd always say, why not? When I'd come up with an idea, and people say, you can't do it. It hasn't been done before. It may be risky. I said, so tell me why not? So if I didn't get an answer, I'd move forward.
Well, to the extent that as a young man, you actually changed the pronunciation of your name. You're in high school? What, and kids teased you?
In junior high.
Your junior high?
The kids were kidding me about the name, calling it Broad, B-R-O-A-D. And I said, you know what? I think it rhymes with road, R-O-I-D, so I change it to Broad. And I just did it, and it happened, and I went told my parents I was doing it, and they just rolled their eyes.
They weren't going to change your mind, clearly, as that sounds like from your book that has been you from a very young age, very persuasive. And it sounds like your peers in junior high, they took to that?
It was fine.
So Eli Broad became
Eli Broad. Exactly.
And there are other reasons you like the renewed pronunciation of your name. Why else do you like it?
Well, what happened when my parents were Lithuanian immigrants, went through Ellis Island, the name was B-R-O-D. Somehow they put an A in there. So I thought I'd get back to the original intent and changing the pronunciation.
Talk about unreasonable, because I think for a lot of us, we tend to think of unreasonable and irrational as being very closely related. You draw a distinction. What is that?
I do. Well, you can be artlessly unreasonable, and there's an art to being unreasonable and getting things done. I do draw a distinction. I think being unreasonable in an artful way is a way to accomplish a lot of things. And changes that need to be done, whether it's in business, philanthropy, or otherwise.
And is unreasonable separate and distinct from being difficult?
Well, some people think I'm difficult and demanding and so on. That's part of being unreasonable.
It is part of it.
And you know what? At the end of the day, if you have the right idea and you move forward and get something done, people will respect you for it, even though they think you were heavy-handed or they didn't agree with you to begin with.
So results trumps everything.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Eli Broad, Los Angeles area philanthropist. His book, The Art of Being Unreasonable, Lessons in Unconventional Thinking, which combines experiences from his boyhood as well as the building of the two companies, Sun America, which was later acquired by AEG. He has been at the center of the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. Mr. Broad, I want to talk about research, because over and over again, not just one chapter of your book, you get to the issue that, you know, forget the conventional wisdom, do your own research, and then follow that to make a decision. But that's easier said than done. So, you know, how do you determine which research is the most important, and when do you stop? Because, you know, you can go on and on and on with research.
Well, I believe in getting as much information as I can. I read four newspapers every day and always have. I read all the trade magazines and so on. And from doing that kind of research, you get all sorts of ideas. And then, of course, you do other research. You talk to other people that are so-called experts and so on. And out of all of that, you come up with ideas and conclusions on what ought to happen.
I don't think you say this explicitly in the book, but one of the things struck me is you were able to parlay things you knew to then do research and go into other stuff. So you weren't really starting at ground zero with each one of the projects you took. They appeared to be very different, but there was some kind of an expertise or experience you had you could apply to it, at least to get in the door.
Well, for example, I was a young CPA in Michigan and got bored after 2 years, and we had some clients that were home builders making a lot of money. And I said, gee, I don't think they're all that bright. Maybe I can do that. So we did some research. Homes in Detroit all had basements. But in Ohio and Indiana, they were building homes without basements. So I said, why don't we do that? And everyone said, no one buy a home without a basement. Well, we ended up building homes without basements with carports 15% less. And the first weekend we opened, we sold out all 17 homes we had.
So you didn't have to excavate for the basement. The foundations were less expensive, and people didn't need to store coal anymore in the basement.
Exactly. And we built the homes a lot faster.
And one of the points you make, again, is that you really need to know your customer. You need to understand what their needs are. And I love the story about Kaufman Broad moves from Michigan into Arizona. You start your Southwest expansion. You come to Southern California, and you see Huntington Beach as a prime area to invest. People like to live close to the ocean, but don't necessarily have a lot of money to spend for close-to-beachfront property. So your strategy there was fascinating.
It was. We ended up building townhouses, which had not been done in Southern California. And they were 1, 2, 3, and 4 bedrooms, Hunting Continental townhouses, a great success. And it allowed people to live near the beach for about 25% less than a typical single-family home. We also had a great community center, a pool, and so on. Great success. I think we sold 760 homes in 6 weeks.
Also, managing risk. I mean, I find that fascinating because you've had to take very big risks along the way, but you make the point that the risk always, you need to know what you're risking as you do it. So how do you determine how much risk to take on?
Well, you want to look at the downside. In other words, if it didn't work out, what happens? For example, when I went in the home building business, what was my risk? My risk was I'd fail, and I'd have to go back to public accounting, and that was okay. In other ventures, you never want to bet the whole farm, so to speak. You want to know what your downside is. I think not taking risks is the biggest risk.
So much of the recurring theme, I think, in your book is managing emotions. We all have emotions. You clearly very emotionally invested in all the different enterprises you've been involved with, including philanthropic endeavors. So how do you bring your emotions as part of the process but manage them?
Well, I wouldn't be doing the things I've been doing in philanthropy unless I really believed in them. And some things I've become very emotional about. For example, in K-12 education, I'm really ill that our children in America are not getting the type of education that children in other countries are getting, where China, Japan, Korea, Finland, India, and so on. So I get emotional about that and try to make a difference.
You say it's better to be respected than loved. And I first wonder, is that a necessary trait? Is the really the only way to get respect to not care about getting love? And secondly, is there something lost in the process when even if there's a great result and you say that sort of fixes everything when you have a good result, but is it really worth it if the process is hell getting to a good result?
Well, I think you want to choose goals that are achievable. And along the way, you're going to run into people that say it can't be done, it hasn't been done before, and so on. At the end of the day, if you get the right result, whether it's getting Walt Disney Concert Hall built when everyone said it's dead, ready to be buried, no one liked the architecture originally, it was too complicated, I went ahead with my dear friend Dick Reardon, who was there then mayor, and we raised the money and made it happen. So at the end of the day, we ended up being respected.
Let's talk more about Walt Disney Concert Hall, because it had really stalled. It was dead in the water. You got the county that wanted its money for the parking garages, I recall, and it just wasn't happening. You went to was Buffy Chandler to talk with her about what to do. And so what did you take from there that you were going to have to change if this thing was going to be revived?
Okay, look, it started with Walt Disney's widow, Lillian, giving $50 million for a great concert hall. 7 years came and went. The county spent $120 million building a three-story parking garage below it and building a deck for the concert hall. The design had been on the cover of New York Times Magazine, all the architectural magazines, and it was dead. And I said to Dick Reardon, Dick, we can't let this happen. It's too important to our city. So we went out there and just raised an awful lot of money, promising people the money would only be used for construction. And I was the first donor. Dick Reardon was the first donor, calling on lots of people, finally got it done.
I want to ask you about your love of contemporary art and the collection that you've amassed, the loans that you make to art institutions around the country, because the way you come off in the book, you wouldn't seem to be wired to be a natural artsy kind of person. What is it about this modern art that connects for you?
Edie was the first collector in our family, and the first work we bought was not really contemporary art. It started with a Van Gogh drawing, a Matisse drawing, a Picasso painting, and so on. And as time went on, we moved forward in time. It was a progression. And I started meeting artists, museum directors, museum curators, and I found that fascinating, great educational experience. Because if I spent all my time with lawyers, other business people, bankers, I wouldn't be fulfilled. So I've gotten a lot out of art. Artists look at things very differently than we business people do. And I like to tell people, civilizations are not remembered for their bankers, lawyers, or business people. They're remembered for the arts.
That our conversation with Eli Broad from 2012. Eli Broad passed away on Friday at the age of 87. He left his mark in so many different areas of Los Angeles life. And let's hear first. We have a number of guests lined up to talk about these different aspects, but with Fernando Guerra, professor of political science and Chicano Latino studies and director of the Center for the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount University. He's also an emeritus member of our SCPR Board of Trustees. Fernando, your thoughts on the impact of Eli Broad in all these different areas?
Oh, he had a tremendous amount of impact. He was someone who could mobilize people, mobilize money. He could get on the phone anyone who was significant. And, you know, he will be missed. Los Angeles would be a much better place today if we had more Eli Broads. Having said that, he was, you know, impatient. He was unreasonable, and he wanted to just get to the point. If he wanted to build a building, it was like, let's get that building, or some. If he wanted this outcome, he would get right to it. And he was very impatient. I had the pleasure of meeting him maybe 3 or 4 times, never alone, always in a group. Always the only Latino, and I think my role at that time was to kind of bring up those issues. And while he was respectful, there was even in his body language a sense of, you know, there's no Latino way of building a building, or Anglo, or African-American. Let's just build it. And he didn't want to take those issues into account. And I think that that frustrated him. While thousands of Latinos enjoy the venues that he helped build and foster, it was not directly in his mind. And certainly the greatest impact he had on Latinos, I believe, is his role in helping charter schools be established. The vast majority of kids attending charter school, contrary to this myth, are actually Latinos and throughout the city and even the county. And so the Latino community does owe a debt to him in terms of that process. But, it frustrated him that he had and to deal, and the city had to deal with communities and ethnic issues, et cetera. He didn't feel comfortable, and they thought they got in the way. But all the time, at least when I was with him, very respectful.
Fernando, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and kicking off this time as we remember Eli Broad, billionaire philanthropist here in Los Angeles, who died Friday at the age of 87. That's Professor Fernando Guerra, Professor of Political Science and Chicano, Chicana, Latino, Latina Studies, and Director of the Center for the Study of L.A. at Loyola Marymount University. Coming up, we'll talk with former L.A. County Supervisor and former City Councilman Zev Yaroslavsky, and our own Adolfo Guzman Lopez, who'll talk in more detail about the educational legacy of Eli Broad and the controversies that came his way as a part of that process. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. I'd like to hear from you. If you knew Eli Broad, if you worked with him on any of these projects, please share your memories at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Back in 1 minute. For many years, Dr. Stephen Koonin was a professor of theoretical physics at Caltech, also provost for a decade at Caltech. He then went to work for the Obama administration as Undersecretary for Science in the Department of Energy, and now is a professor at NYU. He's author of a new book, and he'll be joining us to talk about it coming up in a few minutes. It's titled Unsettled: What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Professor Stephen Koonin joining us in just a few minutes on Air Talk here on KPCC. Right now, we're remembering Eli Broad, billionaire philanthropist who had a reach into all different aspects of life here in Los Angeles, public education, the arts, and development of the Grand Avenue Arts Corridor. With us, someone who worked with him on those projects, former L.A. County Supervisor and former L.A. City Councilman Zev Yaroslavsky, who now directs the Los Angeles Initiative at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. Zev, good morning. Thanks so much. And first, your initial thoughts on the passing of Eli Broad.
Well, I was listening to your interview with him, Larry, and it just brought a smile to my face because I've had so many conversations with him over the years. One of the most consequential philanthropists and civic leaders in the city's history. I put him up there with the Huntingtons and the Chandlers and the others who helped make this city what it is today. He dedicated the last almost quarter century of his life completely to philanthropy. We have a number of billionaires in this town, more than our fair share. And if half of them had the sense of civic responsibility that he had, as Fernando said, this would be a much different city. I found him to be, people say he was difficult. I actually didn't find him to be that difficult. I've dealt with more difficult people than him. He cared about the city. He cared about his legacy was what the city would look like and all of the fields that you just mentioned. He was consequential in all of them. Disney Hall would not be here today if it hadn't been for Eli stepping up and saying, we can't let this fail. If you remember, the project was floundering during the early 90s when we had the civil unrest, we had an earthquake, we had a pretty serious recession. The notion that we could resurrect this thing, in fact, the county administrative officer came to me and said, we need to pull the plug on it because we're paying the debt service on the garage. It's costing us $8, $9 million a year out of the general fund. We can't afford to do this anymore. And I said, no, we can't afford not to do this. And Eli stepped forward with Reardon, with Andrea Vandekamp, and they raised the money that we were finding it very hard to raise. And when Eli called you, you had to take his call, whether you were a politician or a newsman
or a radio host
or a billionaire, people had confidence in him. He had an idea. He had a goal. He had an objective. And the objective was not for self-aggrandizement. It wasn't for him. He wasn't making any profit out of this. He was doing it for the city. So Grand Avenue, which you mentioned, look at all the fingerprints that he has on the Museum of Contemporary Art, on his own museum, the Broad, on Disney Hall, on the School for the Performing Arts at Sunset and Grand. I actually tried to convince him or dissuade him from building his museum on Grand Avenue. I said, Eli, nobody's going to come to downtown to see contemporary art. This shows you how ignorant I was. And Santa Monica wanted it, and Beverly Hills wanted it. And he said, no, I've got to put my money where my mouth is. I've been advocating for Grand Avenue for years, and if I don't do it, it would be hypocritical of me. And he did it, and it's a huge success. And it was a catalyst. And that's the other thing I want to mention, Larry, is that his commitment, his civic involvement was contagious. There are a lot of other things that he had less to do with that happened because he had something to do with the other things. Disney Hall was a major turning point in the city's history. The County Museum of Arts expansion, the Natural History Museum's expansion, a number of cultural institutions that were built during the latter part of his life happened because he set the bar and people wanted to emulate him. I still say that we need more of our wealthy folks to have his kind of civic responsibility. There are very few, and I'm not sure we'll ever see another one like him.
Also should mention his educational philanthropy in higher education, as a number of local institutions were recipients of his gifts as well. We're remembering Eli Broad, who died Friday at the age of 87, and we look forward to your memories. If you knew Eli Broad, you want to comment on it, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Zeb, before you go, I do think it important to mention that Edie, his wife, was a huge part of what he was about as well and a big influence on him.
No question about it. She's a culture, she ate up culture like I eat Pink's hot dogs. she got him involved in art to begin with. She was a big supporter of the opera, of the Philharmonic. And the thing that people don't realize about her influence on him is that he listened to her, right? He knew that she knew of what she spoke. And so it may not have come across that way, but I could see it in their relationship. And I say again, all of the things he did in these last 25 years of his life, when he turned his life into venture philanthropy is what he called it, that was for the good of the city. And I can't think of anyone who has been more consequential to the city in the modern era and to its landscape, cultural, educational, scientific, and higher education. He was a major donor to USC, to UCLA, to Caltech. He invested hugely in his institute on stem cell research. This was a man for all seasons, and his wife, Edie, who is a wonderful, wonderful human being, and both of them, when my wife passed away a couple of years ago, couldn't have been more solicitous in embracing of me at the time, which really touched me. You know, I'm a kid from Fairfax. I'm dealing with one of the richest guys in town, and I never felt subordinate to him, and he never made me feel subordinate. It was always an exchange of ideas. Sometimes he agreed with me, sometimes he didn't, but at the end of the day, we found our ways. The same thing with him and Frank Gehry. They did not get along when the Hall Project was being resurrected, but they made it work, and they set aside their own differences for the good of the city, and that to me is the legacy of Eli Broad. He did it for the good of the city and the good of the region.
Zev, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for sharing your memories, your time working with Eli Broad on some of these huge projects for the cultural life of Los Angeles. We appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
Zev Yaroslavsky, former LA County Supervisor and former City Council member, Director of the LA Initiative at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. We were talking about the effect of Eli Broad in public education, and with us to focus on that more specifically is KPCC education reporter Adolfo Guzman Lopez. Adolfo, good morning. So good to have you with us. And share with us, first of all, just the many ways in which Broad was involved with education.
Well, you know, what's interesting, Larry, is listening to that interview you did with Eli Broad makes me think of Eli Broad's approach to building things, right? So he built houses, he built MoCA through some of his donations. He liked to build things. So now when he shifted his attention to education, it seemed like he took the same approach, right? Gave money, picked certain issues to be involved with, surrounded himself with people. But you will find quite a few people in Los Angeles who disagreed with the way in which Eli Broad pursued his philanthropy in education. There were big, big fights between some of the people that Eli Broad endorsed for LA Unified School Board, the mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa's efforts to take over the school district. There are a lot of people in Los Angeles who were happy that Eli Broad's influence has waned over the last 5 years in education, Larry.
And what were some of the things that Broad was pushing for, as opposed to, you know, specific candidates or expansion of charter schools? Were there particular educational methods or approaches that he was advocating that, you know, set him opposite, say, United Teachers Los Angeles or other stakeholders in education?
Well, here's where we need to retell these stories over and over again. So 1992, the crisis in Los Angeles, the 1990s, LA Unified is seen as too big, unwieldy. There are efforts in the city of Los Angeles, San Fernando Valley, to break away. There are efforts in LA Unified for certain parts of it to break away and form their own school districts. Out of the 1990s come certain reform movements, a reform movement called the LEARN reforms, in which school district administrators and the teachers union are working together to decentralize decision-making at the school district. In comes Eli Broad, the billionaire philanthropist. I don't know how many times I wrote that in stories, Larry, over the last 20 years. And very important Democratic funder. Democratic National Convention happens in 2000. He funds the election of a slate of candidates in 1999. They carry out some of this decentralization, but the teachers union opposes some of that decentralization. And he then pushes for the election of Antonio Villaraigosa. Villaraigosa loses the first time he runs, then he wins. And the teachers union ends up beating back some of these reform efforts to give the mayor of Los Angeles, for example, more control over appointing the school board members, as was the case in Chicago, in New York, which Eli Broad and Richard Reardon, who was mayor of Los Angeles in the late 90s, early 2000s, they really liked that model. So Charter schools also became something that Eli Broad funded quite a bit, and also all the infrastructure that came to supporting charter schools. The legacy is mixed as to whether those efforts move the needle on education.
We're talking with KPCC reporter Adolfo Guzman-Lopez, who's covered education for so many years and giving us a terrific overview of the effect of Eli Broad, the places where he clashed with stakeholders in public education, and even the process by which he did it. Now, Adolfo, maybe you can expand on this, that Broad was not someone to just make a donation and say it sort of goes to a general area. He really wanted very specific limits and direction on how that money was going to be used, which can be very challenging to do in education.
So what's interesting, Larry, is that the recent announcement that Austin Buettner was going to step down as superintendent made me think that during the time that Eli Broad was involved in LA Unified School Board politics, oh my gosh, it was always about, okay, who's Eli Broad going to endorse this time? How much money is going to be spent? And numerous times, spending, not limits, but the amount of money that was spent in a particular race in LA Unified, surpassed what had been spent before. And there was palace intrigue as to what Superintendent Eli Broad wanted in. And there's none of that now, right? Or at least very little of that. We could talk about how, maybe the media landscape has changed in LA, but I think it's a function of, Eli Broad not being as active in pushing for his agenda in the last 5 years and detaching as a person from that.
You referred to him as Superintendent Eli Broad. Was that a Freudian slip or was that
intentional? Sorry, I'm sorry.
No, yes. I was because you could say that intentionally, because
you
of his influence.
Because he wanted to, as some of your previous guests have pointed out, and I spoke to former school board member David Tikhovsky earlier today, who also said that what Eli Broad put his finger on was that a great city is made by its arts and culture and its education. And so Eli Broad was very involved in the museums and the cultural environment in Los Angeles, wanted to turn Grand Avenue that stretched from Beaudry on south. And look at it now, right? You've got the Our Lady of Angels Cathedral, the Broad, you've got Disney Hall,
Colburn
great
School.
Examples. Absolutely. But so many of those donations, Larry, came with strings attached. And one example that I was thinking about is how when the Arts High School was being built in LA Unified, the former school district headquarters, Eli Broad pledged a multi-million dollar donation. But he wanted the building, because it was on grant, to be on the par with Disney Hall, Frank Gehry, and others. So he was really pushing for this Austrian design firm called Co-op Coop Himmelblau, Blue Sky, to be the designer. And that drove the price up of the high school. David Tikhovsky at the time told me, it's not blue sky, it's sky's the limit.
We have to end on that. Adolfo, thank you so much. Great to talk with you. We appreciate it, giving great insight into Eli Broad, his impact on Los Angeles, particularly in education. KPCC reporter Adolfo Guzman-Lopez with us. And again, Eli Broad, for decades, a significant force in Los Angeles philanthropy in the arts, education, development, died Friday at the age of 87. Our condolences to Edie and to his family and his staff members, many of whom have been with him a long time, those who've worked with Eli Broad. We offer you our deepest condolences. We'll continue on Air Talk with former Caltech professor and provost, now at NYU and formerly a member of the Obama administration, theoretical physicist Stephen Koonin, will be with us in 90 seconds on Air Talk.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.